Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
I'm 12 years old. Growing up in Maryville, Tennessee, we all watch the Vols. Ooh. Take a weekly beating in the SEC, and then the whole town talks about how good we used to be.
Way back when
Peyton Manning was our QB. Guess I thought he'd die. Based on the tears that tend to well in the grown-up's eyes. Ooh. So just imagine when I first beheld the man making Sunday bunch of the best defenses in the NFL.
Is that God or Peyton?
Peyton Manning, I cannot tell.
But I'll follow him.
All over the map, from Indianapolis to Denver, slice of Papa John's for dinner. Oh, my hallelujah.
We bow our heads.
One nation in shotgun formation out of the Hollow with number 18 calling audibles.
Omaha!
Oh, my hallelujah.
You may recognize musician Chris Thiele from his bands Nickel Creek and Punch Brothers. He's charmed audiences with his skills on the mandolin, his unruly hair, and his aw shucks manner. Chris Thiele has won Grammys, MacArthur Genius Grant, and now he's inherited one of the crown jewels of public radio. Starting this weekend, he'll be taking over as the new host of A Prairie Home Companion, which airs Saturday nights here on WNYC. Chris, a very warm welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Ilya. How are you?
I'm great. You want to tell us a little bit about that song that we just heard, Oma Hallelujah, about Peyton Manning?
Well, that is an entry into the long storied catalog of sacred football music. I was trying to draw a parallel between our very fine country's relationship with religion and football.
And there is a religion there, indeed, and we're going to get to that in a minute. First, I just wanted to check. You're out in a studio in Portland, Oregon. I ask the folks there to put out a tray of fresh powder milk biscuits for you. Did you get the biscuits?
I have not. They've stiffed me.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I'll
where are my powder milk biscuits at?
I'll have to get on the email with them. You are the new host of Prairie Home, but dedicated listeners have already heard you perform many, many times as a musical guest. What age were you when you first got on the Prairie Home stage?
I was 15 years old. My mother and I drove south from Murray, Kentucky, where we had moved, actually recently moved from Southern California. We drove south to Nashville and flew up to the Twin Cities. And he was a hero of mine. He still is.
Garrison Keillor.
Garrison. We had listened to the show just about every week my parents started listening in their early 20s. I was born in 81 when they were both 23. So I had been hearing Garrison's voice, since conception.
And I know young people who don't necessarily love being forced to listen to public radio with their parents. You were a fan of the show at the time.
A massive fan of the show. If I was aware that it was actually broadcasting, I would lobby for it to be turned on. If mom and dad had forgotten, because I wanted to hear. For me, it was a welcome window into the acoustic music community, but also the sketches and the news from Lake Wobegon. I mean, even as a cocky adolescent, I wanted to hear the news from Lake Wobegon. I never felt like Garrison was just talking to people in Minnesota. I felt like he was talking to me.
Uh-huh. And so Garrison's Lake Wobegon obviously is out somewhere in Minnesota, I guess, upper Midwest. Where would you say your Lake Wobegon is? You said you were born in California?
Yeah, born in Southern California. My Lake Wobegon is somewhere out in the ether. Like a lot of us these days, I think I'm of diffuse origin.
Uh-huh.
Kind of Southern California, but then we moved to Kentucky, and then I left home after a year and a half of college there at the local Murray State University, and then moved to Nashville and then to San Francisco and then lived in New York actually for 8 or 9 years, and I believe I'm gonna move back before too long.
And how did you come to
your fine city?
How did you come to first pick up a mandolin? Because it sounds like from the start, like you were gonna be a musician.
Yeah, I think in addition to the 2 hours of Prairie Home a week, that was on Saturday. I guess it came on at three p.m. out there. We would then drive to a local pizza place and hear this bluegrass band called Bluegrass Etc. Play for another couple hours. I think my fate was etched in stone from that point on. I mean, with a solid 4 or 5 hours of music on Saturdays, and then much more in the house. Mom and Dad always playing. Dad's a musician. He plays the bass, and Mom comes from a ton of musicians and is very musical herself, never really took it up seriously, but then Dad professionally is a piano tuner. There was a lot of music around the house and in the family, so I think it was just a matter of time.
And why this particular instrument, and why, I guess, bluegrass music, but really bluegrass with very much of a twist?
Well, nothing is in California is the pure unadulterated McCoy. It swirls around with everything else and becomes some sort of a new delightful thing. Bluegrass is no exception. Made its way out there from the hills of Kentucky and changed into many things. And I just thought that's what it was. I was never purposefully blending things together. I just kind of felt like music was all a big giant blend, and I still feel that way. As far as the mandolin, I think it had to do again with that the fellow who led the band at that pizza place. His name is John Moore, a very fine mandolinist and a very charismatic performer. And I think I as a young little boy, kind of gravitated towards, like the quarterback on a football team or pitcher on a baseball team. And he was the leader of that band. So I wanted to do what he did, and he played the mandolin. Also, the mandolin was small and high-pitched, as was I at the time. So we matched.
When I told people that I was going to be interviewing you, I got a couple different kinds of reactions. Everyone who knew your name, Chris Thiele, said, "Oh my God, I love Chris Thiele." And then there was kind of this split between the people who say, "Oh, thank goodness, like we need somebody new. We need to completely change Prairie Home Companion." And then the people who said, "Oh gosh, I hope he keeps like Wobegon. I hope he keeps those funny skits with the sound effects. Please let everything stay exactly as it is." So, what's your plan?
Well, clearly I can't make everyone happy. Because those two things, they are mutually exclusive.
Yeah, pretty much.
But I think people would detect artifice if I were to tell them the news from Lake Wobegon. I think it would come off as insincere from a 35-year-old, sort of ostensible Southern Californian. But I share their fear of losing the skits and the sound effects. I think that is such a wonderful, in concert with the music and comedy and everything, the fake commercials. I think that's just the most compelling, whirling dance of variety that just propels the show forward. The comedy makes you want the music, makes you want the comedy, and so forth, until the 2 hours have gone by in a flash. So the format of the show, I think, requires absolutely no tweaking. And then it's just the actual content to make sure that, again, human beings are so good at detecting insincerity or artifice. and we have to make sure that the show sounds reasonable coming from me as opposed to coming from Garrison Keillor. But again, I think he created a format, a brilliant, immortal format, a means of organizing potentially disparate content into a cohesive whole, and I would be loath to change that.
This is Ilya Meritz in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Chris Thiele, who is the new host of A Prairie Home Companion, set to debut in, 5 days' time? What can we expect? What's your first lineup going to be like?
So the debut show, I'm very, very happy with the debut show. Our two musical guests, every show we're going to have two musical guests and a spoken word guest who will often be a stand-up comedian, but perhaps an actor, a storyteller, poet, et cetera, et cetera. Our two musical guests are Jack White, of whom I'm a massive fan. Man, he is just what a consistently great source of good music he has been. And then Lake Street Dive, I think members of whom live in Brooklyn, but they open for my band Punch Brothers a few years ago at the Bowery Ballroom, and I was listening to the set going, oh man, next time I see them, it'll definitely be us opening for them. And then our spoken word guest is Maeve Higgins. Incredible Irish comedian. I was just thinking this morning about how it would be fun to maybe for we musicians to do maybe a set of Irish fiddle tunes, talk about that. There's this great Irish jam. Everyone should go on 10th Street between Avenues A and B at the, 11th Street between Avenues A and B, called the 11th Street Bar. Great pint of Guinness, by the way, but it's a killer Irish session on Sunday nights. And I thought I might actually talk a little bit about that and how they go about making music there. In honor of Maeve's appearance.
Uh-huh. Did the producers of the show want you to sort of self-consciously kind of maybe seek out a little bit of a younger audience? I mean, those are definitely some names that I don't think I've heard on the show before.
I certainly don't think they'll be upset if we add a bunch of young people to the listenership, but we're not going to actively gear the show towards millennials. It's not all of a sudden that all the jokes are going to be about Snapchat.
I hope not, because I'm really bad at Snapchat.
I'm the worst at it. I'm such a Luddite. I really don't understand the first thing about it.
My
sister-in-law actually works there. I should know something about it.
Yeah, well, I don't know. So what was your process like over the summer? Presumably you spent a lot of time kind of workshopping the show, feeling your way, or were you just dumped into this? How did this come about?
A combination thereof. Working on things, testing ideas out on the road, actually. Various ways of getting into and out of music and into and out of comedy. I did some shows at this wonderful music/comedy club in LA called Largo. The fellow who owns it and runs it, Mark Flanagan, has really created an amazing safe haven for people who are making music and jokes. And to try and interact with comedians and again just polish that aspect of things on my end, how to make music and comedy work in each other's context. I mean, they want to work. They are inclined to work in each other's context, but I haven't done a whole lot of it and I'm about to. Wrote a bunch of music. Did a bunch of extracurricular activity, non-Prairie Home activity, but the nice thing about it is, with Prairie Home being a variety show, anything I do is kind of work for the show.
Yeah, absolutely. What so How did you get the job? Did you apply? Did you have to do a demo or anything?
No, it came out of the clear blue sky. I was just minding my own business on a tour bus in Ann Arbor, Michigan, touring with the great bassist Edgar Meyer, and on my caller ID shows up, you know, this long, the Garrison's long noble name, Garrison Keillor, on the caller ID.
Oh, he was already in your phone. Voicemail.
He was in my phone because he would occasionally call last minute. Hey, Chris, could you fly to St. Paul maybe tomorrow for a show? And I let it go to voicemail because I was in the middle of a rehearsal and then also figured, well, I mean, if he wants me to play the show tomorrow, there's no way I can make it. So I'll call him back later. And he left me this voicemail saying, Chris, I have something of interest to you to talk about. Or maybe not, but either way, call me back. And
you've been working on your Garrison impression.
What's that?
You've been working on your Garrison impression. It's good.
No. My voice, with my voice being pitched a full octave higher, it's difficult.
Uh-huh. Okay, so he called you up. He was interested.
He called
in
me up.
You.
I call him back, and he lays out this whole plan. I mean, basically what we're now in the middle of, and I sat there in stunned silence, trying to process it all, but as unprepared as I was to hear it, it also made sort of an alarming amount of sense to me. And I called my wife right afterwards and talked it all out with her. This is the right thing to do, right, honey? I mean, this sounds right. And she concurred. I called him back the next morning to make sure I hadn't imagined the whole conversation. And he said, no, that sounds about right. Let's do a couple of them to see how you like it and how we like it, and then we'll talk.
So you had a hiring committee of one, as far as you know.
As far as I know, yes.
And what kind of advice has he given you?
The constant piece of advice, which is good, and it may sound trite because we all get this advice at some point, is to be, you know, he says, Chris, you got to be yourself. He may hear me do a certain thing and say, Chris, that doesn't sound like you. That sounds like you trying to sound like me or trying to sound like a late night host or whatever it is. That doesn't sound like you. That's the best piece of advice I could hope to get. I've always been a decent mimic from early youth, but also keenly aware that mimicry only gets you so far, and at best can be humorous, at worst can be insufferable. So you know, again, me doing my best Garrison Keillor, and I don't mean the vocal
impersonation. I hope we get to hear more of this Garrison Keillor. Just occasionally, you know, maybe when you're reading out the credits something.
Perhaps,
make me really.
Perhaps.
I would tune in. I would tune in like just for that.
Oh well. Okay. Well then, there's.
Well, hopefully
there's
for
one
the whole
vote
show
for
too.
It. But yeah, I think as far as, you know, imitating his cadence or style of observation or even simple into and out of things. You know, I have to not do it like him because no one could do it like him. He's one of the best who ever lived. I have to find my own way.
So where do you think this fits in with your journey as a musician? I was Googling you a lot before the interview, as you do. And I found this clip of you. You couldn't have been more than about 9 years old, and you're there in like a striped shirt. I think you might have had a cowboy hat, and you're looking very precocious and talking to the interviewer. And I saw later you appeared on the cover of like a guide to how to play the mandolin. You must have been about, I don't know, 20 years old. You had sort of Backstreet Boys hair. So like where does this like fit in now, you know?
I think this to me seems like a fairly logical step. Not that I was expecting it or anything. Just that. As far as the things that I'm interested in, this is a fairly ideal situation. I love to make music, and I love to put on a show, and I have to do both here. And for instance, this show coming up. So I've set myself the task of writing a song a new song for every show, and the song, you know, might tend to have something to do with things that are going on in our world that we're sort of all having to sift through.
I can't imagine what that could be.
Golly, man, I was just lit before we went on live listening to All Things Considered there. Boy, oh boy, what a circus.
Yeah, a bit of a circus. Are you going to talk about Mr. T and Miss C?
I sat down on, I start working on the new song on Sunday, and I sat down and I told myself, I'm not going to write about Trump.
Wait, this is before or after the debate?
This is before the debate.
Okay.
I'm not going to do it. But then, of course, the surest fire way to start thinking about Trump is by saying you're not going to think about Trump. It's like, it's amazing. It's like when they tell you in school you can't look directly at the sun, what's the first thing you do?
This is disgusting. Let me taste it. Yeah.
You try. Exactly. Ew, smell this. And so I have to admit that the song of the week is going to be a little Trumpy.
Uh-huh. All right.
It's going to be a little Trumpy. I ultimately felt like not writing about him was just rank avoidance.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, hopefully it'll be radio safe, or at least you'll give them enough time to bleep it.
Yes. I don't think Prairie Home purchases the 8-second delay. So all the more reason to tune in. I mean anything could happen, folks.
You know, it's interesting. We only have a few minutes left, but one thing that's kind of interesting to me about your career is you obviously learned, you know, to play mandolin real good, and you learned sort of classic bluegrass, and you've met people like Bill Monroe, considered the father of bluegrass. Then at a certain point, you kind of departed. You did covers of Pavement and Fiona Apple and Radiohead, as well as a lot of kind of classical stuff that really sort of seemed to go off script. And now, in a way, you're kind of being called upon to do the same thing. Are you prepared to irritate and disappoint some people on the road to creative self-expression?
I think people, however it might strike them initially,
because there are purists,
will be disappointed.
Public
if
radio
not...
has a lot of purists out there.
Absolutely. But I think, overall, we have people listening who love good things and understand that occasionally, that actually the better something is, the better the chance is that you won't love it right away, because there'll be some aspect of it that's new and initially uncomfortable. I think all the best stuff out there takes a little getting used to. That only things that are wholly derivative are wholly comfortable the first time through, and
why you can kind of like clap along with the cover band, but ultimately it makes little impression.
Right. Ultimately, you're well to have a stiff drink when you're listening to that, and it can be wonderful. I mean, I think a comfortable listening experience is great, but one that will get in there and challenge you a little bit, I think is ultimately going to be more satisfying. It's the difference between having your expectations met and having them exceeded. Occasionally, having them exceeded feels like simply not having them met, but I think that's a temporary feeling.
One last thing before we're out of time. I'm kind of curious. You're a Southern California guy, and I just can't think of a part of the country that is more different to the, you know, Lutheran, reserved upper Midwest, this thing that has really characterized the show. Are you going to bring in, like, I don't know, like skater culture, you know, Mexican-American culture, any of the things that we know Southern California for?
To the best of my ability, it's just all fair game. I would say, though, that I was raised rather similarly to Garrison in a very conservative Christian household.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We were up there in the mountains above Palm Springs, and it was there were a lot of rugged individualists up there, And it wasn't as Southern California-y as Southern California gets. And my parents have since moderated fully, but back then it was very conservative. So we share that, and I'm very comfortable wearing those clothes at least.
You can hear Chris Thiele as the host of A Prairie Home Companion starting this Saturday on WNYC FM 93.9 at 6 o'clock. It also airs Sundays at 11 on AM 820. Chris Thiele, the new host of A Prairie Home Companion, congratulations on snagging this amazing job. Best of luck. I'm really excited to hear
much.
What you do. And it's a pleasure talking with you.
Great talking with you, Ilya.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Some New Yorkers may identify with Clara, the character played by Sonia Braga in the new film Aquarius. She's the last holdout in a building slated for destruction, battling real estate developers intent on removing her so they can build a luxury condo tower on the site. It was the talk of this year's Cannes Film Festival, both for the incandescent performance by Ms. Braga. You've got to see this movie because that is true. But also the political controversy caused when the cast and crew protested the ouster of the Brazilian president and the new government retaliated by refusing to nominate the film for Best Foreign Language Oscar despite its critical success. Aquarius opens tomorrow at the Angelica Film Center, and I am delighted, I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, I'm ecstatic, to welcome Sonia Braga and the film's director, Kleber Mendonça Filho, to the Leonard Lopate Show. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Okay. The movie is so beautiful, so wonderful. I just got to get that out there. But Sonia, can you tell us about Clara? I mean, we know she's a widow, a mother, a grandmother, music critic, and a cancer survivor. She's a pretty complex woman, isn't she?
Yeah, it is. She is a very complex person, as everybody is. Like anybody that is a woman, especially nowadays, would be a complex person because, you know, we're not much seen by society, not for the industry for sure. So to see this a woman in the screening is big already. Mm-hmm. You know, it's wonderful. But Clara is a very, very special woman. That's true, very complex woman, because she's been seen with this beautiful eyes of Kleber Mendonça Filho, who is the writer. And when I read this screenplay, this was the best screenplay that I ever read, with so many layers. And what is beautiful about Clara in the surface, the first layer, because there are so many, mm-hmm. it is the way that she relates to people. She's not one person and one flat person. To everyone, she relates differently. So she has a lot of issues as a woman of 65 years old. And she has friends, and she has a grandson, and she has this person that tries to get into her house from mm-hmm. the front door, so she cannot allow that to happen. And, well, we cannot give away too much of the movie.
I was going to say, I mean, in this movie, Kleber, Clara she's such a dignified, regal presence, and I love the way Sonia talked about how she's a different person depending on who she's with. When you wrote this part, did you specifically have Sonia in mind?
When I wrote the script. No, don't no. be surprised, but I'll explain. When I wrote the script, I had this crazy idea that I would find the perfect Clara on the street in a supermarket at a deli.
Hmm.
But after a while, of course, it proved to be a very bad idea because it's a very demanding role. So once I understood that I would have to go for a professional actress, I went for the best and the biggest, and that's Sonia Braga.
Mm-hmm. And the... I'm sort of taken by your characterization of her, because I'm looking, reminding myself of all the people she comes into contact with. And it's true, from the lifeguard, who
yes.
I swear Cloud is flirting with.
to, me too.
Right?
Yes, I think they flirt. They
right.
don't know, but they flirt.
Right.
They're at the beach, you know, it's sunny, it's nice weather. Why not?
Right. There's the young son of the developer
yes.
who's flirting with, I swear, is flirting with Clada. But
that's a different kind of flirting.
The grandson.
Oh, the grandson
oh, yeah. of the developer.
The
young guy
yeah,
who
but,
looks back up as you're looking over. And
yeah, but this is a different kind of flirting. It's a flirting to harm.
Mm. And that's that gets good. Us into the discussion about, so your character, Clara, is the last person in this apartment complex.
Yes.
It was the apartment of her aunt, Lucia. Is that, was it her aunt, Clara's
yeah,
aunt?
Yeah, it belongs to the family for mm-hmm. many years. And yes, there is a strong emotional, almost spiritual connection between this older aunt and then Clara, and then possibly a young character that shows up in the film halfway through.
Mm-hmm. It's a funny that we talk about that. Every time we are in interview, I say, oops, there's something that I just got. Maybe now that Clara is going to pass to her nephew, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. It's about the human beings, about people with a taste mm-hmm. for music, taste for life. So she gets the strength from Tia Lucia, but maybe Clara has the sense that the next generation of women are going to be so strong that it's her nephew that's going to need to be mm. strong.
Mm. And we're sort of getting ahead of ourselves, but why won't Clara sell her apartment? Is it the fact that that's it's more than home to her?
It is her memories first. Everything is in there. It's a home where she have her kids, and as she says, you know, this is my place. Why do I have to move? Give me a reason. And mm-hmm. nobody can really give her a reason why to move.
And sometimes,
and because she has the right to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in life you do things because you can.
yeah.
But I think that's one of the points, because this whole situation that was created for Clara in the film, it was artificially created in a lab. I mean, it's not part of a natural development of things, of nature, of the city itself. Somebody came up with a plan to make more money, and she's in the way. And and then she identified what the problem is, and she decided to say no. And sometimes when you say no, it becomes a political act. It mm-hmm. becomes a huge issue. And that's mm-hmm. what the film is about, I think.
So the film is set in Recife, in
yes.
northeast Brazil. Why did you choose to set it there?
Because that's where I come from. I live not very far from where we shot the film. And my other film was also shot in Recife. It's my city. I know its little secrets. And I'm actually fascinated by films or filmmakers who make films where they come from. Mm-hmm. You know, we have Almodóvar in Madrid, and you have, of course, Woody Allen and Spike Lee and Scorsese here mm-hmm. in New York City. And I love that very particular taste of the city. You know?
Well, what's interesting in your answer, so Madrid, lots of people know Madrid. Lots yeah. of people know New York City.
Yes.
But I didn't know about Recife.
Now you do.
Now I do, but people know about Sao Paulo or
yes.
Rio de Janeiro. But
Bahia.
Or Bahia.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so was this a way for you to introduce the world to your home?
Not as part of some master plan. It just comes naturally with the package when you make a film. But I remember when I was a teenager, and there was a series of films adapted from the plays of Neil Simon here from New York, and I got to see films that were called Lost in Yonkers, and at the time I had no idea what Yonkers was. And, and of course, by watching the film and then later reading the play, I came to be familiar. You know, I was familiarized with the. I love this idea that cinema will show you a place, And it's happening to Recife right now because mm-hmm. of my films.
I'm Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with actress Sonia Braga and director Kleber Mendonça Filho about their new film, Aquarius. Clara is, yes, she is complex. She's 65.
She is 65, and I am 66 now. Not fair. I'll be 70, and she'll be 65.
She'll be 65, but she is young. She lives her life as if she's 30 years. She's 30 yes. years younger. I mean, we see Clara as a mother, a grandmother. We see her as a friend. We see her as a sexual being.
Uh-huh. We are. I have a surprise for you. We are.
But I mean,
you know, women nowadays, you know, if you see the women, it's because they are not in the biggest screen, but we are all over. Women now at my age or even older, you know, they are so strong, they're so young, they are ministers, they are running for presidency. Don't forget to vote.
And, imagine
yes,
who you're
please,
talking
don't
about.
Forget to vote. And prime ministers, scientists, and everything. Women at my age right now, they look young. They are. Mm-hmm. We are very young.
You know what's interesting is, you know, you have a full on love scene, as they would say when I was growing up. It's a full on sex scene that you have. Clara, that she's 65 years old. I'm a big James Bond fan, and in the latest James Bond, Inspector, there's a love scene between James Bond and an older woman. Is this a trend?
But it is a surprise when you see an older man with a 20 years old. No, it's not a surprise.
No, you're right. That's
or
a
you
sexism
go like,
of our age.
He could get another younger woman. I don't know. You know, when a man... When a man do things in the movies, especially, not a surprise. A woman, it's always checked. You know, mm-hmm. Oh, you have a sex scene. You know, you are 65 years old. I just learned who is pregnant. 50 somebody. I just was in the internet today.
A famous
somebody.
Person.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I just read 55.
Janet Jackson.
Yeah, I guess. It is not surprisingly to see a woman having pleasure. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a surprising thing to see people in... it's part of life. Sexuality is part of life. And I think that you start exploring that at very young age. And to tell you the truth, I don't know when that finishes.
Mm-hmm.
I can come back to your show and say, excuse me, I have some news for you. It stopped.
I somehow don't think that is going to be the case. So there's another thing that happens in the movie, and I'm going to ask you this, Kleber, because...
Better to ask Kleber than Kleber, me, huh?
Well, I mean, well, you haven't heard the question. You can chime in once you hear the question. Adding to the layer of all of this, there's just a simple scene. Clara is getting up. I believe she's either doing her stretches or she's just come back from the beach. She's looking out the window. She pulls up her top.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned before, she's a breast cancer survivor.
Yes.
And we see her full frontal. And it just happens as a matter of course. And she moves on. And then the scene moves on. Why was it so important to not only have us know that she has breast cancer, but to see that she has had breast cancer?
Well, of course, I mean, the image of a mastectomy is an extremely strong image. It's a woman who has a breast missing. I really believe that when I make my films, I try to bring, or maybe they just come out very naturally, aspects of my own personal life. They come and are part of the film, and I did have someone very close to me who had breast cancer and mastectomy, and I thought that it would be a very interesting and strong aspect of her personality and the mm-hmm. character. Mm-hmm. The same way that I believe that Clara at 65 would never be the granny archetype. You know, she would always be a very young 65-year-old woman. Because I actually believe now that the 65, the 70-year-olds today in 2016, they're actually the youngest 70-year-olds we have ever seen mm-hmm. because of the way society has progressed. So in answer to your question, it really comes from my own personal experience. And this is something, actually, we've been getting amazingly beautiful letters from not only from women, but from men who have gone through the whole process and they feel represented by the film and the way it's depicted.
Sonia, how did you feel playing that scene?
Oh, wonderful, because we always want to be honest, you know, about what do we do. And when you were asking, my answer that I had in my head was, it is because it's a movie. In the radio, you would describe that. Mm-hmm. But in a movie, you have this tool of showing the images, and the images will speak by themselves. You don't have to explain anything, you know, and it's a very fast scene. And I think anything that a character is in the movie, like we're talking about sexuality, we talk about flirting with this wonderful man at the beach, or being like nasty almost to somebody that's hurting, try to hurt her. So the scene when she gets the blouse comes from the beach and get the swimsuit down, and you see that it's natural to her now. It is being long time, it's natural to her, and the scene goes naturally.
I should also say that Sonia has such a strong screen persona over so many years. She's a film star, and mm-hmm. I think it's actually very brave of her to let herself be seen with such a strong image of mastectomy. Of course, it is. It's a trick. It's a CGI. It was specially made for the film. But she's actually getting a lot of questions from journalists who think that she might have had a mastectomy.
Trust me, I went online immediately after that scene and typed in Sonia Braga breast cancer, and there was nothing there. Real quickly, why did you thank you very much, Kleber, Sonia Braga,
thank
for being
so
here.
Much.
Aquarius opens tomorrow at Angelica Film Center.
We swoon over French food, we clamor for Thai, we get downright smug about Indian cuisine. In his newest book, Mario Batali celebrates the big, messy melting pot that is American cuisine. Big American Cookbook presents 250 out-of-the-ordinary recipes from across the U.S., from Navajo fry bread tacos to shrimp jambalaya and Ozark pudding. Anyone with a sense of culinary adventure will delight in eating their way across the country. Mario Batali counts 25 restaurants, 10 cookbooks, numerous TV shows, and the Eataly marketplaces among his ever-expanding empire of deliciousness. Big American Cookbook is published by Grand Central Life and Style. Welcome, Mario.
Thanks for having me.
So you grew up in Seattle. Although you grew up in Seattle, you're best known for Italian food. What made you want to write a book about American cooking?
I have been traveling around the country either promoting my Italian books or just traveling for vacation or enjoyable pleasure. And every time I go somewhere, I always ask the locals, where the best place to eat that doesn't have a reservation policy?
Because you're not planning ahead.
Exactly. And that's where you find the local and traditional dishes that make up the backbone of American real cuisine. This isn't a selection of recipes that you need to source at exotic shopping locations online. This is stuff you buy at the regular grocery store. And provided you pay attention to it, you can make some really delicious, interesting, thoughtful dishes from all over the country that I fell in love with in each little place that I stopped.
Now, when many people think of American cuisine, they think, you know, Thanksgiving turkey or cheeseburgers. But how do you describe American cuisine?
I describe it as basically however anybody got to wherever they are through whatever thread of immigration, where we ever found ourselves is how we became who we are. And whether you're from Northeastern Europe or whether you're from the Mediterranean or whether you're from India or China or Morocco or South America, Central America, your immigration story tells a lot about you. But as you embrace America and everything great and often odd about America, you modify it and you become something completely part of the fabric that is our magnificent quilt. And that's what I discovered along this road. And when you're eating in the northern Midwest, you're really eating from kind of the Eastern European stock, whether it's fried sauerkraut balls or something as delightful as hanky pankies.
Ooh, what's a hanky panky?
A hanky panky is where you take equal parts ground beef and spicy sausage. You cook it until it starts to crackle. Mm. Then you drain it of the fat and you add ricotta and either Gouda or Munster cheese. Then you spread it on toasted black or rye bread and you put it under the broiler. And you serve it as you watch the Cleveland Browns lose yet again.
Oh my God, I need to eat
it
that.
It is so good. I learned it first from Michael Simon, actually.
Oh,
and then
really?
On further inspection into the vast and delightful cuisine of Cleveland, found that it's a regular dish that a lot of people serve at their tailgates or their football parties.
You know, I spend a lot of time with Junior League cookbooks. It's
right.
it's a personal little hobby of mine.
Right.
And I have not come across a lot of these dishes. I mean, I thought that I would know a lot about, you know, off-the-wall America, or just not off-the-wall, but, you know, historic and off-neglected
right.
restaurants. But, I mean, recipes. But a lot of these things surprised me. What were some of the surprising ones for you? I mean, you mentioned sauerkraut balls. You mentioned hanky-panky. Were there other surprises that... surprise dishes that you found when you were traveling?
Well, I would say that each one of them presented me with something delightful. I mean, you know, when you go to Texas and you think I'm going to eat chili, and you kind of know that it's going to be a lot, and there's going to be Texas chili all over the place. But when you discover the magnificent depth of flavor that you get from using four or five different types of chilies, and that there's no beans in real chili in Texas. And it's just like each of these little bites is something that so tantalized me. And so, I mean, I started with probably 1,000 and we edited it down to 250. These are the ones that I think are just kind of remarkable. I mean, you know, it's surprising. I would say like a lomi lomi is surprising. For me, a pear salad is surprising only because it's so intuitively right when you first taste it. You're never like, oh my God, I never would have thought of this. It's more like, oh my God, how come I didn't have this before?
Right. And so when you whittled it down from the 1,000 recipes, well, first of all, where did those 1,000 recipes come from?
Well,
was
as I traveled around, from people. I mean, okay. I would sit down and I would eat at a diner or a Greasy Spoon or a great little restaurant that doesn't have a reservation policy. I would ask either the server or the cook or somebody to describe it to me verbally. I didn't want them to write it down because I didn't want to mess it up.
Yeah.
Nor did I want to deal with, you know, saying I got this recipe from this person. It was kind of like it lived in my head. And then as I tried to reproduce it, it just came from whether it was a restaurant or whether it was at a state fair.
Uh-huh.
You know, those are the kind of dishes that I tasted. And as I kind of made what I thought was the dish, I tried to keep it as pure as possible like they made it, because it would be very easy for me to make it a Mario Batali-ized dish. And so in each of the recipes, or a lot of them, you'll see at the bottom, there's a little orange print where I would say, if I was serving this at my house, I might add a little bit of chopped jalapeno.
Right. And did you keep, so you wanted to keep the purity of the recipe, but did you kind of say that you had several versions of the same thing?
Right.
Then would you pick one version or did you mash them up a little bit?
I kind of mashed them up a little bit. I mean, I wanted it to make sure that it tasted like the one that I remembered in my head.
I see. And sometimes that takes a little
bit
of...
Well, because also I didn't necessarily look at the pure, real, written recipe. But as you said, I was looking at a Junior League recipe, or I was looking at a, you know, a Rotary Club recipe, or I was looking at the Wednesday paper in some small town in Iowa when they did their classic roundup of their favorite dishes at the end of the year. And I would just kind of think, that's an interesting look on it.
There's a lot of history in the book, which I just love, including the origins of a lot of the dishes. For instance, tell us about Kentucky Hot Browns.
Well, Kentucky Hot Browns is basically a turkey and gravy sandwich. And, you know, the when you have them and when you make them, it's very much something you would make after Thanksgiving. But it's very much part of the Kentucky culture, and they're very excited about it. So it's delicious to me, but it's all about the gravy and all about the bread.
And their little twist on it was cheese, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, here's a recipe that I had to look at a couple of times to really take in. Chipped beef dip.
Yes.
Now, where did you have chipped beef dip? And tell us what that is.
Chipped beef dip is where you take a dried beef product and you...
Like a jerky kind of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, like a jerky. But it's not... It comes in a jar. Have you ever seen this product?
You know, I'm actually embarrassed to say I've never seen a jar of chipped beef in my life. Where does one get a jar of chipped beef in New York?
I'm not really sure. If you can find it in New York, I would say maybe you can get it at that English place, Keswick's.
Oh!
I would imagine they have it there.
Okay.
But you could also find it probably online, which I don't want you to do, though. I want you to go get it.
Okay. I'm going to go get it.
But it's a delicious amalgamation of this very... I would say if you couldn't find it, you would find the ends of brazaola and use those because it's a dried beef product.
I love that. That's really like good. It's probably this really sort of humble thing, and then we're going
right,
to use it with brazaola.
We're going to make it $25 a pound if we can.
Exactly. And then you take it and you put it with, you chop it up and make it into a dip?
Yes. It's very much like a cream sauce that you would put chipped beef on toast, which had a funny little renaissance in the American military where they called it something else.
Yeah, we won't repeat that on a family.
It was on a shingle.
On a family radio show, right, like
exactly.
This. Oh, sorry, go on.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to ask you, so when you eat this, is this like something that you put bread in or do you do chips?
You put chips or vegetables if you're trying to be healthy.
Well,
like
really.
Celery sticks.
Yeah, of course. Chipped beef dip with celery
with
sticks.
With celery sticks.
Exactly. For everybody's next cocktail party.
Right, exactly. It's for the fiber.
Another one that I want to talk about is Ozark pudding, just because it's such a simple, humble, homey sounding dish, but I'd never come across it. So it's apples,
yes.
And it's almost like a cake.
Yes, exactly. It actually tastes a lot cakier than you'd imagine, but it's delicious. It's simple and it's apple-y and it's floury and eggy. I mean, I think one of the most amazing things about this book is that there's more desserts in this book than I've ever, ever made.
And pies. Oh my gosh, pies.
And what you'll see is that the pie ingredients are almost always the same. There's butter, there's sugar, there's some kind of dairy, and there's eggs. And as you mix them together, whether it's a chess pie or whether it's even the Concord grape pies, they're almost all thickened in exactly the same way. And yet they come out in such a unique and delicious variety that it's amazing.
Is pie one of your favorite desserts? Or is it just one of the most prevalent things that you
found? Pie is without a doubt my favorite dessert.
Okay.
I mean, actually, no, I'll tell you. My favorite dessert is fresh picked blackberries and vanilla ice cream.
Ooh.
And if I had to choose a dessert that somebody made, it would be my mom's blackberry pie with vanilla ice cream.
And you also did blackberry jam. You
yes.
talked a lot about that in the intro. You talk about growing up and making jam and preserving.
And pickles. And that's
pickles.
A big part of this book.
Yeah.
I mean, I was talking to some other people this morning and they were saying, well, are you worried that pickling is going to become a cliche because some groovy hipsters are doing it in Williamsburg? And I'm like, the last thing you have to worry about is whether if people are doing it in Williamsburg, which is the epicenter of cool right now, that it's going to take away from its initial grooviness. And pickling and preserving is a way that Americans have always done how to live through the winter when you don't have your seasonal stuff and you didn't have a grocery store filled with already made jams or frozen stuff, which is still good and not bad. The idea that you can get a raspberry in February is not bad because obviously people want to buy it. But if you made your own raspberry jam from raspberries that you picked or bought from a local market, it tastes 10 times better. And in that same way, when you harvest so many beans at the end of the summer and you actually pickle them like my Aunt Marty made dilly beans, it is something that is so... It's a moment of pride for you, but when you serve them to someone and they're so good and they're so personalized, that's what American cuisine is. It's really personalizing all of these things by doing it your own self with your own hands. And when I taste something that someone made with their own hands like that, that for me is the ultimate gift. Like for me, I'm so much more impressed with that than I am with caviar or foie gras or fancy stuff.
Oh, good. I'm going to get you dilly beans for Christmas then.
Fantastic.
It'll save me a lot of money. No, but you know what's interesting about what you said is that preserving, pickling, canning culture is so deep and it is so ingrained, not just in our society, but in every society. Anybody who needed to preserve food and needed to eat through the winter has a tradition of canning, right? We're not going to let, you know, the fact that it's trendy now take away from how essential it is to us as humans, really.
Right. And not only essential, but it's an expression of your own personal way. Like how many ever thousand ways they make duck confit? There's a thousand ways to do it. But it was because they didn't have ducks in the winter. So you preserved all of the bounty of during that special season, and that's what makes sense. And whether it's super salty or whether it's super thymy or super garlicky or super rosemary, that's all the beauty of the individual cook.
A caller says that you can get chipped beef at Acme, a New Jersey and Pennsylvania grocery chain. Thank you very much for calling in.
Fantastic.
And also another caller, Jessica from New Jersey, says that her grandmother made Ozark pudding in Syracuse, New York. And they have German roots, and it's a flat cake and it's sort of like granola, and you'd crumble it. Oh, this is interesting. She would crumble it and put it and put whipped cream on top. And so I guess it would almost be like a fool, you know, or a trifle.
Really?
Interesting. And her family still makes it.
Fantastic.
Well,
I would love her recipe.
You can send the recipe to Mario. He'll be waiting for it.
Fantastic. I love the idea of crumbled cake. I think, you know, that's also very trendy right now in New York restaurants, where they take a cake and they tear it up and put stuff on the plate so that it looks a little bit different than the circular mold.
And also think about, I'm so done with the circular mold, so I love the difference in presentation. But let's also talk about cornbread crumbled into buttermilk. You know, that was one of those things that I read about in Southern cookbooks.
Right.
And until I did it myself, I never realized that it completely changes the cornbread, it completely changes the buttermilk, and you're just, you've got this new...
It's this new mush.
It's this
that
new
is
delicious.
So delicious.
I'm Melissa Clark. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate, and my guest is Mario Batali. His new cookbook is called Big American Cookbook, and we have a few recipes on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Let's talk about some of those recipes. One of them is Amish beef and noodles, which to me sounds a little bit like chicken and dumplings, except with beef.
Yes.
And so tell us about that. It's a
kinda,
big stew?
Yeah, or? It's kind of stroganoff-y.
Stroganoff-y, okay.
But it's not got dairy in it. And the noodles are kind of puffy and plump, so they're different. It's a slow-cooked thing, and it's perfect for the kind of weather that we're just about to approach.
Yeah, and we should all, you know, make it this weekend when it's going to be getting a little bit chilly. Here's a question, though. It calls for hand-cut Amish noodles.
Yes.
Is that something you make or you can buy?
You can buy them at the Amish store here in New York City.
The Amish store on 10th Avenue?
Exactly.
Okay, that's perfect.
Right. Or you can just make your own regular pasta noodles, just like you do from any of my Italian cookbooks, and just cut them like that. I roll them as opposed to thin like I would for fettuccine. I would roll them almost like between a 16th and an 1/8 of an inch thick, and mm-hmm. I cut them kind of wide and irregularly.
Okay, along those same lines, there's a recipe in your book called Bot Boy, which is, that is like a German chicken and dumplings. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that recipe?
No, right off the top of my head.
Okay, so you have like a chicken, almost like a, like imagine chicken and dumplings. You have
right.
your chicken soup with the big pieces of chicken in it, and then you have these homemade noodles, and they're very slippery.
Right.
And that's possibly the bot boy. Is possibly comes from pot pie.
Oh, right.
And then it's pasta, though, instead
right.
of pie
and
crust.
And we put it under the broiler. I remember that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it gets kind of nice and firm on top. It almost feels like a pot pie because it gets crisp under the broiler. Delicious.
But you have with pasta dough instead
yes,
of that.
Yes, exactly.
Instead of
a flaky crust.
See, that's... why I like this book so much is because it's constantly surprises
right.
me.
Right, thank you.
Okay, let's talk about, you write about the South as being a place that is very close to its culinary history and its culinary roots. Do you
yes.
want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think that, you know, all of America has amazing traditions and a lot of really cool things, but there's no place that is still a little less touched, a little less modernized, a little less more tied to its true traditions as the American South. And whether that's in New Orleans and Louisiana in the Cajun and Creole cooking, or whether it's kind of the low country cooking of the Carolinas, or whether it's the barbecue, or whether it's the Gulf Coast and where you're eating just, you know, the simple flavors of the local seafood catchery, just barely presented or barely mm-hmm. treated, that's where I think you have the most, for me, the most authentic and most interesting flavors around the country. The ones that have been least chefified. You know, when I still go down there now and you get a po' boy and it has either shrimp or oysters or even just a fried grouper sandwich, for me is one of the greatest things I can ever have. And if I'm looking at the Gulf of Mexico and I didn't have one for breakfast, I have made a vast mistake.
So that's it. You like savory breakfast. You also write about clam fritters
yes.
being one of your favorite
Absolutely.
Breakfasts in the New England chapter. One of the interesting things about the way you organize this book is, well, it's by region, which is intuitive,
right.
but then you split up the states sometimes.
Right.
So you have New York both in New England
and in the Great Lakes. Right.
And Alabama, it's Gulf Coast and also in South.
Right.
So,
because they kind of fit into two different ways. I mean, when you're in Buffalo, you're closer to, I mean, you're almost on Lake Erie, right? So it feels like you're in the Great Lakes, and the food is different than it is in New England. And, you know, the people in Buffalo, when you talk to them, they don't feel like they're upstate. They're actually offended by being upstate, and they certainly don't think of themselves as New Englanders. They're definitely Great Lakes, and they're closer in kind of strategy and cooking and people to the Midwest and the Great Lakes people. So that the food is different. I mean, when you have beef on a weck, I mean, there's probably five or six variations on a roast beef sandwich. Beef on a weck, the weck itself is this amazing bun with the seeds and the salt, and it's just something so delicious. I fed one to Jimmy Fallon last week. He said it might be the best thing he's ever had in his life. I'm like, Fallon, come on.
Really? Wow.
On TV?
He's,
well, I think he's being
maybe,
a little bit
maybe he meant the best thing that he's ever had in his entire life that day.
That day.
Yeah.
I believe that might be true.
Okay, but why I want to just take that apart a little bit more because I'm interested. Why is Buffalo so much more like the Great Lakes? And what is that strategy of cooking? You said that in there's this particular strategy of cooking there.
Right. Well, I don't think they have the roots. They don't have the New England style cooking roots. They don't have like a Boston feel to Buffalo. Buffalo feels a little bit more Midwestern. And Boston and New England feels very coastal to me. Mm-hmm. It feels very colonial. Buffalo doesn't. Buffalo feels to me a lot more aligned with Toledo and Cleveland than it does, and Cincinnati than it does, say, Boston and New Hampshire and Providence, Rhode Island. Providence, Rhode Island feels to me, the cooking is for me, is almost Italian and then a lot of seafood. The stuffies, for example, the stuffed giant clams that they eat there, feels a little bit more like New England-y to me. And that's kind of where that region.
What about the Portuguese?
There's a lot of that. And the sausage with the shellfish feels good there. And there's an Italian Portuguese, there's a Mediterranean backbone to that that you don't necessarily find in the Midwest like that. For me, the Midwest is more kind of Northern European, Eastern European.
Let's go back to the South for a second and also the Midwest. Let's talk about the American tradition of barbecue. This is a huge topic. There are so many styles of barbecue. Can you just talk a little bit about the different barbecue styles?
Well, in North Carolina, there's three distinct styles. There's the whole hog, there's the shoulder, and then there's the chopped, very finely chopped shoulder and whole hog, where they take the crispy bits of the skin and they chop it up all in it. Sometimes they pull it. But basically, it's really divided by how you sauce it. North Carolina is kind of two or three basic sauces. One of them is just a red vinegar and chili flakes and no tomato-y at all. And then another one has a little bit of ketchup in with that same thing, and it's still kind of spicy. Then in South Carolina, they have a mustard-based sauce that is kind of a reduction of vinegar, a little bit of hot sauce, a little bit of butter, and yellow, like Coleman's mustard, French's mustard. And they kind of smoke the meat in a very similar way. They don't really treat it that much differently. It depends on whether you're using shoulders or whether you're using the whole pig. And then it's how they serve it. And it's perhaps the most beguiling and delightful thing going on in America right now. And you can get it a lot of places. You can definitely buy smoked meats. One of my favorite places to get barbecue in New York is at Hometown Barbecue in Red Hook.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
And there's a guy named Billy Durney that makes it so spectacular. But I wouldn't say that it's North Carolina style. It's not South Carolina style. It's not Texas style. It's not Kansas City style. It's its own thing because he uses a lot of Asian flavors. But what he does have mastered completely, and I love the Asian flavors in his stuff, but what he does have mastered completely is that slow, harmonious balance of the smoke and the meat and the fire. And you're in there and you're tasting it. It's just like, I rarely eat bad barbecue when I'm in North and South Carolina.
And then don't forget, I'm sure the Texans will be calling
right.
up.
Well, I love the Texas barbecue, but I got to say, like the brisket I was late to brisket. I didn't ever really figure it out for a long time because I was always thinking I wanted ribs.
Well, you know what? Brisket is glad to have you back. Mario Batali is going to be signing copies of his new cookbook this Sunday at noon at the Bookmark Shop in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. He'll also be signing books at Books and Greetings in Northvale, New Jersey on Sunday, October 30th. For more information, visit wnyc.org/lopate. Big American Cookbook, 250 Favorite Recipes from Across the USA, is published by Grand Central Life and Style. Mario, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.